I next met with Dr. Philippe Moreau, and to begin, he presented an 82-year-old man from his practice.
This gentleman was sent to the clinics because he was presenting with bone pain and with fatigue. In fact, the blood test revealed that the patient had an anemia with a hemoglobin level of 10 grams per deciliter. And on the electrophoresis, we noticed an M spike of 45 grams per liter. The isotype of the M component was IgG kappa, so he was suspected to have a multiple myeloma. We showed on the X-rays diffuse bone lesions of the skull, the pelvis, and the bone marrow aspirate did confirm the diagnosis of myeloma, showing 35% of plasma cells. We immediately looked at the international staging system status of the patient, and the beta 2 microglobulin level was high, above 5.5. It was 6.2 milligram per liter, so the patient was ISS-free.
Could you kind of talk a little bit about how you saw him, what kind of lifestyle he was leading, and also any other comorbidities?
This gentleman didn't have, in fact, any comorbidity. He was retired for more than 17 years at the age of 65, and he was enjoying quite a normal life before having this fatigue and bone pain, in fact.
So this older patient brings up the issue of the so-called FIRST trial that really has changed the way people think about upfront treatment of older patients with myeloma and really myeloma in general. And you were a primary investigator on this study. Can you talk about the design, the main findings, and what you think it means?
This study is the larger study ever published and ever reported in elderly patients. This study was dedicated to patients older than 65 years of age. It was a three-arm randomized prospective study comparing MPT, melphalan, prednisone, and thalidomide, during a fixed period of time, 18 cycles, versus a second arm with lenalidomide and dexamethasone, same duration, and a third arm of lenalidomide and dexamethasone continuously until progression. And the number of patients enrolled was roughly 1,600 patients, more than 500 patients per arm. And the primary endpoint was progression-free survival. And the study clearly demonstrated that lenalidomide and dexamethasone continuously was the best arm, with a median progression-free survival duration of something like 25 months versus 21 months with Lendex fixed duration or MPT fixed duration. And importantly, the study was also the best arm of the study. Lenalidomide and low-dose dexamethasone continuously was associated with a clear benefit in terms of overall survival when we looked at a long follow-up. So it means that patients are really benefiting for a continuous treatment with these two drugs provided orally. The dose of lenalidomide was adapted according to the age of the patients, less or above 75 years of age, but also the dose of dexamethasone was adapted, and in very elderly patients, instead of using 40 milligrams of dexamethasone weekly, we were providing 20 milligrams of dexamethasone weekly.
So what's your interpretation of this trial? I've heard a lot of people say, well, this is going to bring on the use of lenalidomide dexamethasone in areas that are currently using melphalan-based regimens. And it sounds like, in a way, that sort of is starting to happen or has happened in Europe. But to me, it seemed like the thing that really came out was the difference between continuous or long-term therapy and short-term therapy. Not so much. It looked like, really, MPT and RD were the same if you use it short-term.
Yes, I think that your interpretation is the good one, in fact. We can consider now that Lendex should be used continuously until progression, if possible, if patients are able to tolerate the combination. Because when looking carefully at the data, we noticed that many patients in the Lendex continuous arm had to stop the treatment because of GI toxicity, fatigue, or some neutropenia or infections. So the majority of the patients were able to stay on treatment, but something like 40% of the patients had to discontinue treatment. So the message is that we should try to use Lendex continuously if possible. Nevertheless, if it's not possible, well, we have to stop the treatment.
Let's talk a little bit about dosing. You mentioned that in the trial it changed based on age. When you looked at this 82-year-old man, I'm assuming I think you said he fit into the sort of fit category. So what dose did you use, and what dose would you have used if you fit into the frail category?
In fact, for fit patients, you can try to use 25 milligrams per day, 21 out of 28 days. And in case of frailty or above the age of 75 years, you should systematically think of using a reduced dose of 15 milligrams per day instead of 25. This is for lenalidomide. And then, according to the toxicity, if you are enjoying neutropenia, etc., you can reduce, you have a second step to reduce from 15 to 10 milligrams daily. And then we also have to take into account the renal function of the patients. This is a very important point. With lenalidomide, when the creatinine clearance is less than 30, you have to reduce the dose. That's very well known. We are using now lenalidomide in the relapse setting for years. And that's also the same for dexamethasone. The first full dose is 40 milligrams weekly, continuously. And then in case of toxicity or if the age is above 75 years, we are reducing the dose from 40 to 20. We can also reduce, a second step is to use 10 instead of 20.
So what exactly happened to this man and what's his current situation?
So this man, we selected the dose of 15 milligrams daily of lenalidomide, 21 out of 28 days. And the dose of dexamethasone at first step was selected at the dose of 20 milligrams weekly. Nevertheless, he was not able to tolerate very well the dose of 20 milligrams of dex weekly. He had nightmares. He was not exactly psychiatric troubles, but his mood was changed when he was receiving 20 milligrams of dexamethasone. We know that's a very well-known complication of this drug. So we reduced the dose from 20 to 10. And now the patient is currently receiving 15 milligrams daily of lenalidomide and 10 milligrams weekly of dex with quite a good response.
One other question about this man. Assuming the same man came to you, what would it take? Or are there any situations, particularly in terms of cytogenetic abnormalities, that would get you to thinking in the same exact man about using triple therapy? In other words, for example, RVD light is something that's utilized in some patients, the RVD regimen, but at lower doses. Anything that would have gotten you to do that, or maybe another regimen with a proteasome inhibitor?
Well, that's a very good question. In fact, I did not mention that we are also systematically assessing cytogenetics for all patients when we want to treat them frontline, but also in the relapse setting. And in fact, this patient did not have 414 translocation or 17p deletion that are considered high-risk cytogenetics. It's true then that in patients with, for example, 414 translocation, lenalidomide and low-dose dex is not probably the optimal combination. And we've heard, and at the ASH meeting, data was presented about the MPT versus Lendex combination for subgroups of patients according to cytogenetics. And I think that it will probably impact the use of Lendex because we know that in the relapse setting, Lendex is less effective for patients with poor cytogenetics, and that can be also true for frontline treatment. So in this situation, if the patient is presenting with 414 translocation, you can consider of adding bortezomib, and we know that bortezomib is probably an important tool in this situation, to use a triplet combination with this RVD light regimen that you were mentioning, with bortezomib once weekly in order to reduce also the toxicity. but the patient has to receive bortezomib either IV or now more often sub-Q. So that's more heavy, more cumbersome, that's also more expensive, but I think that in some situation, we can use this RVD light regimen as proposed by the Dana-Farber Cancer Institute group, for example, in Boston.
So that's really a fascinating data set that you're talking about. Now, is this a sub-analysis out of the first trial?
Yes. I'm one of the co-author of the paper. I think that it will be important to check if we need or not to add bortezomib in some groups of patients according to cytogenetics, or if the efficacy of Lendex is really equivalent with or without some of these abnormalities.
That's really fascinating. I'm kind of curious, if you look at older patients, you know, in this age range as this man, what fraction have adverse cytogenetics? And I don't know if it's already been put out there in terms of what fraction of patients in the first trial had adverse cytogenetics.
Well, cytogenetics was carefully evaluated in this study. Well, not all patients who are able to be evaluated for sure, as usual, but nevertheless, we have a very, very large number of patients, and it will be the larger evaluation of cytogenetics in elderly patients. Previously, the French group also looked and published that cytogenetics abnormalities were at the same level according to the age. The 17p deletion, the numbers and the percentages were equivalent to that of young patients. Maybe we had less translocation 414 in elderly patients as compared with younger patients. But roughly, if we are adding 414 and 17p, that represents something like 20% of the patients.
Right. So let's bring in, just to sort of finish out on this issue of upfront therapy in a patient who's not transplant eligible, if you could comment briefly on your 65-year-old man. You mentioned the desirability of oral therapy, and this man on a clinical trial was able to receive oral triple therapy with the oral proteasome inhibitor exazimib Lendex, so sort of an RVD, but with an oral proteasome inhibitor. Can you just briefly talk about how he presented and how he did on this combination?
The exazimib is an oral proteasome inhibitor. That's a boronate derivative, so similarly to bortezomib. And exazimib was tested in a triplet combination with lenalidomide and dex, the IRD combination. The study was published a couple of months ago by the US group, and they looked at IRD, exazomib, lenalidomide, and dex in phase 2 study on quite a small number of patients, but patients were not systematically treated with stem cell transplantation. The goal of this phase 2 study was to provide IRD during a long period of time. And our US colleagues clearly demonstrated that the response rate was very high. Almost all patients did respond. The study was published in The Lancet Oncology, so a very famous journal. And they showed that there was an improvement of the response over time. And patients could stay on treatment during a long period of time. So that's a triplet all-oral combination, very promising. So we have designed in France a study with the same combination, IRD, 3 cycles, and then patients are proceeding to stem cell transplantation. And we are also adding IRD following stem cell transplantation to consolidate the response, to improve the quality of the response. So this is a phase 2 study. Since exazimib is not yet approved, we are only able to use this drug right now into clinical trials. And this phase 2 study was restricted to some 8 centers in France. And this patient was treated into this clinical trial, and he did respond very well to the first 3 cycles. Then he received the stem cell transplantation and currently is receiving the consolidation phase of the study with additional cycles of IRD, this all triplet oral combination at home, in fact.
How did he tolerate the IRD? Any side effects or toxicity?
In fact, when looking at the table of the toxicity in the manuscript that our US colleagues did report earlier this year, in fact, it seems that it is really very well tolerated. Ixazomib is not providing any specific peripheral neuropathy, and this is a huge difference as compared with bortezomib. We had the issue of skin rash with this drug when it was tested first in phase 1 or phase 1-2 studies. But when you are adding systematically dexamethasone, in fact, the incidence of skin toxicity is very low. So I think that the incidence of neutropenia or thrombocytopenia as well is quite limited and mostly related to the lenalidomide use. So we can really think that this triplet all-oral combo will become very, very important in the future. At the ASH meeting, we heard about the results of this triplet IRD regimen compared with RD placebo in the relapse setting, the Tourmaline study. This study is a pivotal study of ixazomib. So ixazomib was prospectively compared Ixa-Lendex versus Lendex placebo. And we know that the PFS was improved with the addition of ixazomib. And probably the triplet combination will be approved quite rapidly in US first and then in Europe because it was an international phase 3 study.
When you look at these trials, I'm guessing there's little or no data comparing, say, IRD to RVD, and probably never will, I would guess, but is it kind of look the same? I mean, in terms of efficacy, is it look kind of similar to bortezomib? I mean, I guess chemically it's similar.
So that's a very good question once again, but it is totally impossible to answer your question. I think that we don't have, of course, any head-to-head comparison of RVD versus Lendex plus ixazomib right now. The number of patients is really small, the patients that were treated and reported with this triplet combination. But we will for sure know very, very soon because IRD was not only tested in the relapse setting versus Lendex, but also in the frontline setting. And we have two Tourmaline trials, one for relapse or refractory patients, and another one that is ongoing with a very large number of patients treated frontline, dedicated to elderly patients, comparing Lendex, one of the standard of care frontline, versus Lendex ixazomib. And we will know definitely what is the impact of ixazomib in combination with Lendex very soon again.
Just to finish out on oral proteasome inhibitors, there is another agent that seems like it's kind of more similar to carfilzomib, aprozomib. And can you talk a little bit about what we know and what we've seen with this drug in contrast to ixazomib? One of the things that we were hearing from investigators was more side effects.
Yes, in fact, aprozomib is currently developed in phase 2 trials. We don't have any phase 3 trials with aprozomib. So ixazomib was very quickly developed, in fact, based on the simplicity of the schedule. That's one pill, flat dose, 4 milligrams weekly on day 1, 8, and 15. So very easy, no important toxicity. On the opposite, aprozomib right now is associated with more toxicity, especially GI toxicity. And we are, well, the formulation of the drug is also currently under investigation. I think that it's more difficult to stabilize the drug into pills. So I think that the company is working hard on developing aprozomib, but I think that we are not yet ready and we don't know exactly the optimal dose of aprozomib, probably the dose that should be selected. So quite a lot of work to be done for the development of aprozomib and probably a drug that will be more toxic as compared with ixa.
So it was really fun preparing for this interview with you because, you know, it seemed like every major paper that we like talking about in general in myeloma, you've been involved with. So, and I see, you know, of course, every time we meet with a myeloma investigator, of course, we ask about the ASPIRE trial that was presented last year by Keith Stewart at the ASH meeting. And I see one of the patients that you submitted here to talk about here today was actually on the study, a 62-year-old woman. Can you talk a little bit about her?
Yes, yes. So this lady did receive, in fact, a stem cell transplantation as part of this frontline treatment 5 years ago, in fact. At that time, she was 57 years old. She was a very, very kind lady, and she was not working. She was diagnosed again with bone pain, and she was living with her husband and also her handicapped child. She had a handicapped child. So for her, that was a really terrible to have this disease, because she had to leave the house to leave this handicapped child. This child was 30 years old, you know, at home with her. So, and she received our standard of care, frontline treatment with stem cell transplantation. And the duration of the response was not that good, in fact, because she relapsed 2 years later. And then at that time, my center was highly involved in ASPIRE study. And ASPIRE is a very important study. That's the pivotal study for the approval of carfilzomib in Europe, with prospective comparison in the relapse setting of lenalidomide and dexamethasone, that is one of the standard of care for relapse patients, versus Lendex plus carfilzomib. And she was randomized to receive carfilzomib, so that was really good for her. And she received 18 cycles of carfilzomib. That was the planned duration of carfilzomib according per protocol. Well, she had to go back quite often to the hospital. That was quite difficult for her because carfilzomib is provided IV on day 1, 2, 8, 9, 15, 16, every 4 weeks. So the patients have to go back to the hospital 6 times per month. That's quite a lot. But nevertheless, the response was fantastic, and she received 18 cycles of carfil, and now she's still receiving lenalidomide and dexamethasone, and she's in complete remission, ongoing. And what is fascinating is that the second duration of response is longer than the response that she presented following stem cell transplantation. She has now more than 3 years of response following carfil-Lendex, when she had only 2 years of response following stem cell transplantation. So this triplet combination is very important, and I think that based on these results, this triplet combo will be approved in Europe. You know that carfil is available in US for years now, but it is not available in Europe. That's a pity for us, but we cannot use carfil right now in Europe. But based on ASPIRE, I think that we are going to use in combination with Lendex in the relapse setting.
Wow, I got to say, I was shocked. I didn't realize that carfilzomib wasn't available. Interesting. Getting back to this lady, at the time she went on the trial, she'd had the transplant previously. What prior systemic therapy did she have? What induction treatment, for example?
Induction, she did receive a combination of bortezomib and dexamethasone, 4 cycles. And then she proceeded to stem cell transplantation with melphalan 200. She received 4 cycles of induction and then stem cell transplantation and no maintenance, because we are not using systematically maintenance, especially in 2010 when she received the frontline stem cell transplantation.
Just out of curiosity, if she were to have presented today a patient like that, 57 years old, what would be the likely induction regimen you would utilize outside a trial setting, and how would you approach the issue of maintenance?
That's a very good question, in fact. Things are moving, and the landscape is moving so fast, in fact. Now we are systematically using a triplet induction, bortezomib, dexamethasone, plus either thalidomide, the VTD regimen, that is one of the standard of care in Europe based on the results of phase 3 studies performed in France, in Italy, and in Spain. So VTD is widely used. Another possibility is VCD, CyBorD. So bortezomib, dexamethasone plus cyclophosphamide. That is one of the best induction regimen used in US, in Canada, in Germany, in many, many countries. Or we have another option of bortezomib, dex plus lenalidomide, the RVD regimen that was published and promoted by the Boston group. So we have several possibilities, but in Europe, we are either using VTD or VCD. Lenalidomide was not approved until very recently, so RVD was not widely used in Europe.
What about maintenance today? Again, a patient like this, 57 years old, they get one of the induction regimens, they get transplant. How do you approach maintenance today?
In fact, we have now a number of trials that are clearly indicating that maintenance with continuous lenalidomide is able to prolong the duration of response. PFS is always improved when you're comparing no maintenance versus maintenance. We do have some trials showing that there is an overall survival benefit. One study performed in US from the CALGB group by Dr. McCarthy as the PI of the study. Another study is coming from Italy with Dr. Palumbo and Cavo. So we are now a number of trials indicating that we should use lenalidomide maintenance. Nevertheless, in this situation, lenalidomide is not yet approved in Europe. So we are using, if the patient is not exactly in complete response, if there is an M spike remaining following stem cell transplantation, in this situation, we can use quite easily lenalidomide. But we are awaiting for the formal approval. And if approved, I think that len will be widely used because we are more and more trusting the results of the PFS and OS benefit of len maintenance.
So let's get back to your patient who was actually on the ASPIRE trial. We kind of got off there on a tangent a little bit. I'm curious, what was her condition when she started out on the Len-Dex carfilzomib? Was she symptomatic? What was her performance status?
Yes, she had a symptomatic relapse. Yes, at that time, it was not only a biochemical relapse because she had bone pain at the time of the progression when she did progress 2 years following stem cell transplantation. So it was really impossible to watch and wait. We know that the definition of progression is NEM progression of the M component of more than 5 grams and more than 25% from the nadir value. So in some cases, we do have smoldering relapses without any symptoms, without bone pain, without hypercalcemia, anemia, or renal impairment. And we don't have to treat the patients immediately. We can carefully watch and wait. But as soon as there is one symptom, well, we must, in fact, treat the patients in order to avoid any severe complication of the disease.
So what happened to her disease symptomatology as she got treatment? And did she have any toxicity issues?
She did respond very, very well and very, very quickly. In fact, she was in a PR following the first cycle of KRD, Carfil-Lendex. She was in VGPR following cycle 2, and she was almost in CR following cycle 3. And then the CR is ongoing with a very, very good quality of response. When looking at the toxicity, for sure, we have to use a systematic thrombosis prophylaxis with Lendex-Carfil, but that's related to lenalidomide. And with carfilzomib, we know that when comparing the two arms of the study, Lendex or Lendex-Carfil, there is an increased rate of cardiac toxicity with Carfil, also an increased rate of renal toxicity. The numbers are not that high. That's 2 versus 4%, 2 versus 5%. But overall, if you are adding myocardial infarction, renal impairment, hypertension, etc., there is something like a 10% difference in terms of grade 3 or 4 toxicity. That can be related to the comorbidities of the patients. This specific patient was quite young when we treated her with the KRD combination, and in fact, she didn't have any prior history of renal impairment or cardiac dysfunction, so she did tolerate very well the combination. What is also important to note is that with the KRD combination, we don't have the issue of peripheral neuropathy. We know that carfilzomib is not associated with neurotoxicity. And again, when looking at these very important results of ASPIRE, we can clearly see that the benefit of the triplet is more important in younger patients as compared with elderly, very elderly patients. So I think that this triplet Carfil-Lendex combo that is highly effective, but also associated with a very, very high cost, is probably of value in younger patients when we want to salvage aggressive disease following stem cell transplantation, for example.
So you mentioned the issue of cardiovascular issues with carfilzomib. You gave the number around 10%. There also has been the idea of patients who experience dyspnea and not always necessarily associated with cardiac problems. I mean, kind of hard to figure out, I think. What would you say the incidence of dyspnea is, and did this lady have any dyspnea?
No, she did not present any dyspnea, in fact. And again, when looking at grade 3 or 4 dyspnea, it is less than 10%. That's something like 5%. Is it related to an endothelial toxicity, a vascular toxicity of the drug? That can be possible. It has not clearly been demonstrated, but you're perfectly right. When comparing the dyspnea rate in Lendex or Lendex-Carfil, there is a higher rate with Lendex-Carfil. Similarly, with hypertension, with also renal impairment, there is probably an endothelial toxicity of Carfil that could induce these specific toxicities.
And do you think that this is heart failure, fluid overload type thing?
Well, at first we thought that it was related to the IV infusion, and with IV we have to hydrate the patient with a saline perfusion. But in fact, we noticed that even in patients without any prior history of heart dysfunction, that could occur, in fact. So that's not related to the hydration. That can be drug-related for sure.
How do you manage patients who have dyspnea, and what do you typically see?
Well, to be honest, I had only one patient. I have enrolled 20 patients in ASPIRE. That was quite a high number of patients in my department, and I had only one patient who did present quite severe dyspnea. I thought that it was at the very beginning, it was something related to infection. It was not related to a heart dysfunction. We did look for pneumococcia. We did look for other fungal infections, for example, of the lung, but it was probably related to carfilzomib. So I don't have quite a lot of experience. We also tested Carfil in a phase 2 study in elderly patients in combination with MP. And I was the principal investigator of a Carfil MP study in elderly patients. And when provided as part of frontline treatment, we did not see very important toxicity with this triplet combination. So for sure, there is an issue, but it is not a very big issue. And how to manage it? Should we use steroids? I don't think so. I think that as soon as we have severe dyspnea not related to an infection, we should stop carfilzomib, probably.
So in terms of the implications of this ASPIRE trial, I guess it also touches a very general point that goes beyond carfilzomib, which is treatment of the relapse refractory situation and 2 versus 3 drugs. And this goes back to discussions in breast cancer about whether you give combination therapy or sequential agents. In terms of globally overall, how do you approach the issue? You mentioned that, you know, in younger symptomatic patients, you want to get a response. But globally, do you think you would see the same survival benefit if you had a trial like ASPIRE, except when the patients on Lendex relapsed, they got carfilzomib then?
Well, that's a very, very important question. And once again, the landscape is moving very, very quickly. In the relapse setting, we had 2 options, let's say, that were approved in Europe, either bortezomib dexamethasone or lenalidomide and dex. And now we have a number of trials recently reported, recently published, showing that the addition of a third agent, Lendex-Carfil, Lendex-Elotuzumab, or bortezomib-dex plus panobinostat is improving the progression-free survival. So more and more we have data showing that a triplet is superior to a doublet combination. What is important is to look not only at the progression-free survival, but also at the overall survival. And for example, with the PANORAMA study comparing bortezomib-dex versus bortezomib-dex panobinostat, we have a PFS benefit, but not an OS benefit. And the toxicity of the panobinostat arm is important. So we have to balance toxicity and efficacy. With carfilzomib, there is an overall survival benefit. So I think that we should favor combinations, triplet combinations that are associated with overall survival benefit, because that's really the goal at the end of the day.
So you mentioned elotuzumab, and I wanted to get your take on the data that was presented at ASCO from the ELOQUENT trial. Looking at that, you mentioned that, but also other monoclonal antibodies, and you've done work, for example, in daratumumab, a very exciting agent. Can you kind of provide an overview of monoclonal antibodies in myeloma and where you think it's heading?
I think that it will be one of the most important steps forward in the future, in fact. Elotuzumab is a monoclonal antibody targeting SLAMF7, that is a glycoprotein that is constantly expressed on tumor cells, on plasma cells. But elotuzumab by itself has no single agent activity. But when ELO is combined with lenalidomide especially, you have a synergistic activity, and the ELOQUENT study clearly showed that Lendex plus elotuzumab was superior to Lendex in terms of progression-free survival. Right now, the follow-up is too short to draw conclusions regarding overall survival. But this drug is not toxic at all. So we have an improvement in the duration of the response with ELO. So that's quite an interesting drug, to my opinion. And next year, probably, we are going to hear about the results of Lendex plus or minus ELO phase 3 study as part of frontline treatment in elderly patients. So we'll have more data on the efficacy of elotuzumab, not only in relapse, but also for de novo patients. To my opinion, the most fascinating agent is daratumumab. Daratumumab is targeting CD38 that is also highly expressed on the tumor cells. It is not toxic, but Dara has a single agent activity. And we've heard at the last ASCO meeting about the results of Dara single agent in very advanced patients, patients that were progressing on carfilzomib, progressing on bortezomib, progressing on lenalidomide, progressing on pomalidomide. And one third of the patients did respond to Dara, and the duration of response was something like 8 months. So we have here a drug that is not toxic, that is very effective. And for sure, the future use of daratumumab won't be as a single agent. We are going to use it as a drug in combination with backbones, let's say, with Lendex, maybe bortezomib dex as well, or other backbone regimens. So we are awaiting for the results of the POLLUX study. POLLUX is a prospective comparison in relapse of Lendex versus Lendex daratumumab. The study enrolled more than 600 patients very, very fast. Well, the goal of this study is to show that there is an improvement in terms of progression-free survival, and we are hoping that there will also be an overall survival improvement. So Dara, to my opinion, will be the first and the most widely used monoclonal antibody in the future. We can maybe reproduce what was done in the past with rituximab in the non-Hodgkin's lymphoma field. Now we are adding rituximab with all the combos, and we think that Dara will be the same, in fact, added to backbone regimens.